Again, may I introduce now, with regard to future activities and future planning, Fons van den Biesen. To you, most of you know him. He is an attorney in Amsterdam. He's vice president of Yalana. We've been together when we invented Yalana somewhere in Stockholm, end of the 80s. Anyway, now he's mainly engaged in pleading for Bosnia in a case before the International Court of Justice against Serbia and Montenegro. The pleading has started. He's a deputy agent for this. The pleading has started 3 months ago, whereas the case is pending before the court already for 13 years. So this is just a short introduction of Fon, and I give right away the floor to you, Fon, for your speech, please.
Thank you very much, Manfred. Good morning. This looks a little bit like a reunion to me, and it's great to see that we are all still here. Apparently, the positive side of the existence of nuclear weapons is that it is an effective medicine against aging. Apparently, fighting against nuclear arms is a benefit to one's health. Sean McBride was mentioned already. I think he was 93 when he died, or maybe 94. Harold Evans was 90. So we all can calculate now the abundance of time we still have available for our struggle. And when you do so, do remember that in soccer games, the winning goals are more often than not reserved for the final minutes before the game is over. Having said that, it is of some concern that so few people in this room are below, let's say, 35. I'm afraid, maybe you can raise your hands if you're below 35. I'm afraid we can count it on the fingers of one hand.
Not really. You need 6 fingers then.
Okay, well, then I'm a pessimist. But in any event, recruiting the young should be higher up, I think, on our agendas. Right now, nuclear arms are threatening world peace more than ever. And the young should know, and we need to tell them, if they don't know, that they cannot afford to leave the struggle against the bomb to the older generation. Now, I was given the topic for this morning's session phrased as the role of the International Court of Justice in the international system and compliance with its judgments. Now, the downside of this being a reunion is that this topic is already well known by most of the people present in this room. But I will say a few words about this, and maybe if there is time, I will say a few words about a topic which will be central to the rest of our discussions today, returning to the International Court of Justice. As we know, the role of the International Court of Justice is twofold. One, it is deciding conflicts between state parties, and two is to deliver advisory opinions. These two activities of the court are of an entirely distinct nature. They both involve law. That's what both connects them. But that's where it also stops. The two activities, for the rest of it, are totally different. A first distinct difference between the two activities is that in contentious cases, in cases between states, it is only the states that are before the court and no one else. In an advisory opinion case, it is not a case between states that is put before the court, not in a formal sense. It just does not involve states opposing each other as such. There are no applicants, there are no defendants. If there is any party at all involved in an advisory opinion case, it is the UN body which has requested the court to deliver the opinion. At the same time, which makes it interesting, as we know, all states that are entitled to appear before the court are entitled to participate in the advisory opinion proceedings. And for our purposes, this means that all UN members may, in principle, participate in the advisory opinion procedure. The procedure in a case between states is also distinctly different from the procedure in an advisory opinion case. When two states appear before the court, or two groups of states appear before the court, it goes back and forth. There is lots of time in between the several rounds, and the court needs to make sure that all positions put by one side may be answered to by the other side. The rounds in an advisory opinion case are not rounds as such, and they are organized in a different manner. In any event, the advisory opinion proceedings are less antagonistic and do look somewhat more informal than the proceedings in the contentious cases. The most important difference between the two sorts of cases handled by the court is the outcome of the two. A case between states will at all times lead to a judgment which will be binding on the state parties that were involved in the case before the court, a judgment which at the same time will not be binding on any other state which did not participate in the case. An advisory opinion does not lead to a judgment. Strictly spoken, it does not even lead to a decision. The outcome of the advisory opinion proceedings is merely the opinion of the court, or, as the court has said in various advisory opinion cases, it is merely the reply to the question. That's all it is. And it follows from these distinct differences in parties that are present, the role of the parties that are present, the proceedings, and the differences in outcome, that the questions of enforceability and of compliance also lead to entirely different answers. Different answers for judgments at the one hand and for opinions at the other. I will come back to that shortly. The advisory opinion practice of the court is considerable in size and also considerable in sorts of cases that have been looked into by the court. Until now, 25 advisory opinions have been delivered by this court since it came into being. In these 25 cases, a great variety of legal questions were put to the court in order to obtain legal clarification. And over the time, in all of these cases, the court has clearly established and written down in plain and clearly understandable language the nature of its work with respect to advisory opinions. The language used by the court says that the court in advisory opinion cases is providing certain clarifications of a legal nature, that the court is enlightening the General Assembly with respect to certain legal questions, and that the court is assisting the body requesting the opinion with respect to certain legal questions. Providing clarifications, enlightening, assisting, these are the more formal descriptions, the more outside descriptions with respect to the nature of its role. But the court has also said already in a case, I think it was in the 50s, that when the court is delivering an advisory opinion, this in itself represents its participation, the court's participation in the activities of the United Nations. The court has expressed as its principled view that a request to deliver an advisory opinion should, in principle, never be refused. There are some thresholds which do exist before the court can start entertaining a legal, an advisory opinion request. The first threshold, as set forward by the court, is that the question should be clearly a legal question. It means that no political questions as such may be answered by the court when a question like that would be put forward in the framework of a request for an advisory opinion. At the same time, the court has acknowledged that most legal questions include political questions as well. And it has set out clearly in various advisory opinions that the fact that legal questions entail and include political issues, political questions, sometimes very important political questions as well, does not mean that it is not a legal question any longer. And that the fact that there may be political consequences or political repercussions from whatever the court advises in its opinion does not mean that the court should refrain from providing the opinion. So that is the only very clear and very strong threshold. It should be a legal question. The other one is that the question put before the court should be about issues which are indeed within the scope of the activities of the body of the UN organ requesting the court to deliver the opinion. This is a formal requirement for all UN bodies other than the General Assembly and the Security Council. And we all know from our own practice as we are assembled here how that works. The WHO question, which was also at the same time before the court with the advisory opinion on the use or threat of use of nuclear weapons, was not answered by the court because the court decided that this was a question which fell outside the scope of the activities of WHO. Whether that is a correct opinion or not, that's a different matter, but it is the opinion of the International Court of Justice, and it means that this is the opinion that for this case provides the ultimate guidance as far as the questions of international law and as far as the questions of the proceedings are concerned. For questions asked by the General Assembly, there is no formal limitation that the question should fall within the scope of the activities of the General Assembly. According to the law, the General Assembly is entitled to ask any legal question to the court. However, in the practice that has been established by the court does engage in some sort of verification that the question put by the General Assembly indeed is relating to issues which, according to the practice of the General Assembly, falls within the scope of its activities. According to the statute of the court is not under a legal obligation to deliver an advisory opinion. The court may provide an advisory opinion, which means that the court has some sort of discretionary power to yes or no answer to a question. But as I mentioned before, the court has developed a practice that in principle it cannot and shall not refuse to respond to an advisory opinion asked by the UN bodies that are entitled to do so. It has stated that it would only do so when compelling reasons would be available to refrain from delivering an opinion. These compelling reasons are not defined by the court, and the practice on the advisory opinion cases is that never has a case appeared before the court that included that sort of compelling reasons. In other words, the court has never refused, by using its discretionary power, to respond to a request for an advisory opinion. I mentioned that there is a difference when we come to the question of compliance, a difference between contentious cases and advisory opinions. In a case between states in which a conflict is decided by the court, the outcome is a judgment, and the judgment is binding on the parties involved. And not only that, it is also enforceable. It is enforceable through the Security Council, who is responsible for doing so if the states involved do not by themselves abide by this judgment. This means, obviously, that in the end, whether a state should be forced to comply with the judgment of the court, in the end, is a political decision in the hands of the Security Council. When we look at advisory opinions delivered by the court, in principle, and that's a principal issue, there is no issue of compliance involved, simply because it is not a judgment, it is only an opinion, it is only a reply. In principle, no issue of being binding or not upon states is involved when we talk about an advisory opinion, simply, again, because it is not a judgment, it is only a reply to a legal question. An advisory opinion is, in its conclusion, not directed as such to any state party in particular. It is a reply to the body which requested the opinion. So there is no way that one state could take an advisory opinion and go to the Security Council and ask the Security Council to enforce the opinion against one state or another. In an advisory opinion, according to the words of the court in one of its opinions, the court merely states the law. Now, that, of course, is a very modest way of describing what the court is doing, because in stating the law, the court clarifies what the law already meant before the advisory opinion was put to the request was submitted to the court. But the court states the law. And this means that the outcome of an the substance of an advisory opinion is binding on all states in as far the law to which it relates when we talk about specific treaties or specific agreements, in as far as these treaties or agreements are already in itself binding upon states. And that is an important difference to know. There are politicians that say, oh, well, we don't have to worry about an advisory opinion because it's not binding. That's true. They don't have to worry that the Security Council will go after their state to enforce it. But it is binding already by the virtue of it being part of international law as such. And it is binding only in as far as that section, particular section of international law, which was at stake in the particular case, was already binding upon the states in question. The most recent example of an advisory opinion which has been actively ignored is, of course, the opinion on the wall, the wall that Israel is constructing on the occupied countries of the Palestine people. It's not the only example. There is a much older case, an advisory opinion delivered by the court with respect to the Western Sahara. There was an issue between Morocco, Spain, and Mauritania, an issue which came back and forth to the General Assembly and then led the General Assembly to formulate this question in and to ask an advisory opinion of the court. Which was also the opinion of the court in that case was also totally ignored. It was interesting in that case that Morocco was very much in favor of this advisory opinion to be asked from the court. And in the proceedings, Spain very much opposed that the court would be entitled to deliver this specific opinion. But the court rejected Spain's objections and issued an advisory opinion, which then was not liked at all by Morocco, who was so much in favor of it. And Morocco completely ignored the opinion, and from that perspective, the advisory opinion didn't help at all to resolve the conflict, and the parties were, and including the General Assembly, were forced to fall back to what they had been trying to do before the opinion was delivered. Only, and that's not nothing, only that there was one more relevant argument at stake, and that was the substance, obviously, of the advisory opinion. And that's, maybe I should conclude with that, although, yes, well, I should conclude with that. That is really what we should be aware of, that the advisory opinion, yes, it provides guidance, and it provides very substantial and important guidance. Yes, it does state the law. It does state the law as it is. It doesn't create new law. It states the law as it is. And yes, international law as it is binding upon states in as far as it is binding as such. But no, an advisory opinion as such cannot be enforced against a particular state as a binding ruling of the International Court of Justice. The importance of the substantive the merits of an advisory opinion, I think, makes it today even more than 10 years ago an indispensable tool for what we're about to do. And especially when we talk about the nuclear disarmament obligation, I think this is where a lot may be won by asking again for another advisory opinion, and I'm looking forward to the discussion on that later on this day.